Next up on Downtown, we welcome back to the program Yale history professor and the author of a number of books, including the wonderful The Field of Blood. Dr. Joanne Freeman joins us this afternoon. Joanne, thanks for being with us. How are you?
I'm good. I mean, I'm as good as one can be right now.
Yeah, I think that's, we have to have that condition with every conversation we have with people. But we've got the whole pandemic going on, but then we've got another situation around the country. As I ask every historian we talk with this, hoping I'll get an answer. How did we get here?
Oh boy. there is no one easy answer, but the best part of your question is the assumption underlying it, that it has taken us a while to get here, that what we're experiencing now, and it's like a, well, I don't want to say perfect storm, but it's a mix of crises that's definitely, each one could be historic, and together it's kind of off the charts, but some of them, you know, they have really deep roots.
And let's look at the pandemic and our response to that. And people have different political views. Obviously, the whole basis of our political parties began with discussions over the size and the role of the federal government. But a pandemic seems to be one of those situations where having a federal government response, keeping states organized, might have been preferable to this every state for themselves approach.
Well, you know, as a political historian and as one who writes about the founding, on that level, this has been really interesting to me because I don't think in the course of my lifetime I've had a moment where I felt that feeling that profoundly, right? That I'm like, hey, where's the federal government, right? Shouldn't something be happening here? And I think probably most Americans, and I think this also includes a lot of historians, kind of takes the basics of our federal system for granted, right? It's a federal system and the states have some responsibilities and the national government has some responsibilities. And then something like this happens and you realize that the flexibility that allows it to work sometimes doesn't work so well.
Well, that's obviously something we're experiencing every day here in America. People have been critical of the Trump administration, and obviously people go to extremes in their criticism or their support, it seems. No one can have a middle-of-the-road view these days. But is the Trump administration going through a systematic assault on the Constitution from a historic perspective?
Well, from a historic perspective, you know, it's really interesting being a historian in this moment because part of my brain responds like a historian and says, well, this is interesting because it reminds me of this and, you know, this is the trend of that. And then the other part of my brain, it just kind of howls like many Americans. I think when I teach the Constitution, and I've been doing that for a couple of decades now, I always say that the Constitution, if you think about how short it is and the amount of work that it has to do, it's really a framework of a government more than anything else. So for two decades, I've been saying, well, the Constitution is a framework. And when it started out, the assumption was that there'd be a lot of improvisation and precedents being set, that it would be figured out as it went along, but that a lot of it is unwritten. Now, I've been saying that for decades, but this is the first presidency where I suddenly realized in my gut that there's a reality to that I haven't focused on before. And that is, if the system is propped up by norms to such a large degree, norms are not particularly sturdy and they're easily stripped away. And that's some of what we're experiencing.
When we have a president who seems to want to expand the power of the executive branch, that's happened along the way. Franklin Roosevelt certainly did that in his efforts to pack the Supreme Court, and others have tried it along the way. But has anyone else been as, I would say, as successful in growing the power of the executive?
Well, I mean, that's a hard, my historian brain has kicked in. That's kind of a hard question to answer. I would say one thing that has been distinctive about this presidency has been the degree to which presidential power has grown by reducing the power of some of the other branches or corralling the power of some of the other branches. You know, early on, under the Trump presidency, I'm on social media. I will confess I'm on Twitter, and I was tweeting about checks and balances, and I was apologizing for it because I thought, well, this is obvious stuff. My apologies, whoever's reading this, but it seems like it's important to note that, that there are different branches of government. They each have different powers and they check and balance each other. And a lot of people responded by saying, oh, thanks for explaining that.
Yeah. Oh,
and
my.
Right. And that really told me that some of what we're experiencing now is a product of who's in power. But I also think that some Americans don't realize the degree to which what's going on now is really warping the system.
And there seem to be a fair number of Americans who are happy with an imperial presidency, who have even hinted that some form of authoritarian government might be better than what we've been accustomed to for 240 years. And there's a part of me that understands that, because we've witnessed more than two decades of congressional deadlock and gridlock. And so there's frustration that things never get done. But I never thought I would live to see a time when so many Americans say, what's wrong with the way authoritarian regimes operate?
Yeah, but I think there are a lot of problems in that assumption, but I think there are two really obvious ones. And one is, I think Americans believe that the United States is exceptional, meaning things just don't get really bad here. We're different. Things always end up for the better. You know, we're always fine. We've gotten through crises. Hey, we got through a civil war. It's all going to be fine. And some of what I'm saying now in my teaching is we can't assume it's all going to be fine. We can't assume it's all going to sink, but we can't assume it's all going to be fine. We are not in that moment now. We don't know what's going to happen. It's a moment of extreme contingency. And so I think some of the people who think, oh yeah, so you know, let's try something different, really still assume that somehow or other it'll all end up okay. The other half of that equation, I think, is that people who say that they would like or are happy with some kind of an authoritarian regime aren't thinking hard about the fact that they might not always be in agreement with the person who's the authoritarian leader, you know, and that if someone is in power who they really disagree with and has absolute power, then what? You know, they might feel differently. So again, part of me thinks that we're in a moment when a real sort of supreme fundamental lack of understanding about our system of governance and what it allows and what it prevents, that people don't really have that. And, you know, the founding generation, you know, Jefferson believed that everyone should get, well, every man, every white man, should get 3 years of education, if for no other reason than that they would understand how the government works and they would recognize threats to it, because a republic is vulnerable and it's not like a monarchy. And that never seemed to me like a radical assertion, but, you know, I find myself thinking about it these days because I just think people don't fully understand the moment we're in.
Well, I agree with that. And as a high school teacher, I see that all the time with students. Now, I was a lad of 10, a precocious one, mind you, but in 1968, when yeah, I heard family members talking about, wow, are we going to make it through this year? There have been tougher times in American history. 1968 comes to mind. Certainly the Civil War years and those years leading up to it. Where on a historical ranking does this time period stand in terms of our divisiveness, yes, but also in the threats to our democratic system?
Right. Well, you know, taking the very long historical view here, I step back and we've had a good number of crises. The four or the handful that stand out to me that you can compare to the present, as you say, 1968, the Civil War and the moment right, the era right before that. And also, you know, the poor founding era kind of gets a bum rap, but the late 1790s was another one of these moments of extreme polarization, one side othering the other as un-American, people worrying about violence, Americans against Americans, all kinds of charges and conspiracy theories. So that was another moment that was very similar to all of these. And what's interesting about all of those moments to me is that in one way or another, those kinds of supreme crisis moments are moments when it's apparent to the American public that there's some fundamental aspect of Americanism or being American that's being debated. So obviously this in the Civil War era, that's slavery. You know, will there be slavery? Will there not be slavery? In the civil rights 1968 fight, it's civil rights. It's that fundamental question of civil rights that's being debated. In the late 1790s, they're talking about how democratic a country as is going to be. And when people elect Jefferson as president, they basically said, well, more democratic than the other side thought. And in a lot of ways, what we're talking about right now is citizenship and what it means to be a citizen and who gets to be a citizen and what rights do we have as a citizen. And in all of those cases, civil rights, citizenship, slavery, democracy, those are debates that are polarizing and extreme and get right down to the roots of what people think the United States is.
We're talking with Joanne Freeman here on Downtown. Yesterday was an interesting day with the early decisions from the Supreme Court in their session, and none of them going the way the Trump administration wanted. And that's a reminder that we do have a system of checks and balances. And yes, particularly with the Supreme Court, it doesn't always turn out the way presidents imagine, Earl Warren being an example, David Souter in more recent years, and perhaps now with Neil Gorsuch.
Right. And that is a very fine reminder that there are still some checks and balances that are functioning. I mean, part of what we're looking at now is the politicization of parts of government to a degree that I don't think we've certainly seen in a very long time, if ever. And so it's nice to see a court that, although people have been worried about its politicization and the appointment or the prevention of the appointment of justices, it did operate under its own volition and come up with a decision that didn't agree with the people with executive power. And even just on that basis, above and beyond the decision itself, that was nice to see.
As the COVID-19 numbers spike in some parts of the country and we close in on an election with polls showing the president trailing by double digits in many places, what power does the president or the executive branch itself have, if any, to change, postpone, put off the election?
Well, there's a question. You know, it's a hard question to answer, primarily because we're seeing so many things happening and so many things have happened that I would never have predicted can happen. So if you're asking me, formally speaking, does a president have the right to postpone or delay or prevent an election? The answer might be, well, basically no. But if you're asking me, in this extreme contingency moment when we really don't know what's happening, who's going to step forward and actually enforce constitutional law, who's going to step forward at all, I don't know. And I think, you know, it's a frightening thing for me to be an American historian and say, I don't know if we're going to have a free and fair election in the fall. I say it because what that means is, as Americans, we have to be aware of that, and we have to stand up and we have to really force forward the things that will help create a free and fair election. We have to preserve the U.S. postal system. We have to work against voter suppression. We have to get people registered. You know, none of these things are partisan. They're all aimed at getting people to vote. They've been politicized in a way. But we, I think Americans need to be really aware that this is a moment where all of those things have extreme importance. And there's honestly, I will be watching with everyone else to see what's going to be going on in the fall.
And I think the nightmare scenario that people are already discussing is what might happen if Joe Biden were to win the election and Donald Trump refuses to accept the results. And I go back again to the founders and the election between Adams and Thomas Jefferson. That was an incredibly bitter election. But John Adams, well, we weren't sure how that would play out at the time, but he took the high road. Could we see a scenario where a president refused to do that? And what are the next steps?
Well, that's a good question. And in 1800, that was part of it, was Adams going home. The bigger, scary part and the kind of big unknown in 1800 was that the two Republican candidates, Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, tied. And then the election was thrown to the House. And then the big question was, uh-oh. Right. Now what happens, right? Because Byrd did not say, I know you guys meant for me to be vice president, so I'll step down. He didn't, right? And so it took 36 times of voting to fix that problem, and people were arming themselves in some states, and it was a real crisis. And ultimately, it was the members of the House that agreed to allow the election to move in the way that they felt it had been intended to move. But that was a close call. I don't know, you know, what that means about now. I mean, even if, you know, we were in a situation where somehow or other the election was thrown into the House, who knows with the House the way it is and the Senate the way it is, I have no idea. And who knows what state they'll be in after the election. So I have no idea. I mean, the question of what do you do if someone is elected president and the person who is in the position says, sorry, I'm not leaving. I don't have an answer to that question. I don't think anyone has an absolute answer to that question. And I think anyone who says, oh, well, you know, it's wrong. It's against the rules. He can't do that is not thinking along 2020 lines at the moment.
Has Congress, and I would say particularly the Senate in the Trump era, have they not only abdicated a lot of their power, but have they reduced their power going forward in our system of checks and balances?
Well, certainly for the present, they're not exercising in any way their independence as a body and as a part of a branch, right? And that's pretty fundamental. So all we know already, and we see that every day, about the ways in which Mitch McConnell coordinates things with the president and then tells the Senate basically what to do, and the Senate largely does it. And that's a major check that's been destabilized and weakened in some way. The positive thing about the Senate and Congress is that it's going to be totally remade in the next election. And the way that it works really, really depends on who's in power and the majorities and minorities of the people in power. So although one might say, wow, the Senate has now proven that it can or can't do things that others might want to do again, and that's true. But to a greater degree, I think, than the executive branch, it remakes itself, the Senate slightly less often than the House, but still, Congress remakes itself with every election, and the American people have a chance to put people in power, different kinds of people, a much greater representation, different sorts of people that at least have the option for more change, for the opportunity for more change down the road.
You've written eloquently about the history of violence in Congress in your wonderful book, The Field of Blood. Could you have imagined a scenario where a United States senator challenges an actor to a wrestling match with his friend in Congress?
No. And that's saying something, because, you know, I wrote a book that has like 90 incidents of physical violence in the U.S. Congress. And even after that, when this came down yesterday about this mess between the actor Ron Perlman and Ted Cruz and Jim Jordan and the sort of weirdness of wrestling matches and challenges and fights. Even I was surprised. And then also my second thought was, oh no, I'm going to be getting a lot of email and tweets today. People are going to be saying, oh, we know who can say something about this. Joanne. And Joanne really doesn't know what to say about this other than the strangeness of it makes it so much of the current moment.
I couldn't have said it better right there. I have to ask you about a couple things beyond the world of politics, because I saw this on social media yesterday. Your brother, are we talking about Mark, got a swimming lesson from Steve McQueen?
Oh, he did. And he's going to love the fact that this came up during this conversation. My youngest brother, Mark, we were moving to L.A. We were staying at a hotel, a nice hotel being put up by the company that moved my father. And we were sitting around the pool, and my brothers, both of them, couldn't swim. And a very nice man with a very big beard, kind of scruffy looking, came over and asked kind of if we wanted or if my brothers wanted swimming lessons, and then went over and asked my mother if she would mind if he gave my brothers, and I think ultimately it was Mark, who had the swimming lesson. And my mother said yes, but at that particular moment, when a famous person got a phone call, typically they didn't say, you know, well, blah, 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 come to the phone. That person usually has a number. So they would be like, you know, well, number one, come to the phone. And a number was called and this guy went to the phone. So my mom looked closely and realized after not a very long amount of time that this was Steve McQueen, who apparently had just broken up with Ally McGraw and was living in this hotel. So Steve McQueen gave my brother a swimming lesson.
Wow. That is
and
fantastic.
I will be sure to tell him that I got to tell this story.
Well, we love your brother, love his new book on Modern Family. It's so wonderful.
It is indeed a wonderful book. I'm so proud of him, I can't even say.
All right, and you mentioned this too yesterday, so I have to ask, all right, what was your favorite? You have great recall, you say, of 70s TV commercials. Which one comes to mind immediately?
Oh, gosh. wow. Well, the one that comes to mind is really obscure and not politically correct in some ways. There was a breakfast cereal called Freaky's Cereal. And I'm not going to sing you the song, but I could sing you the theme song from the TV commercial for Freaky Cereal. And that all by itself, you know, that part of my brain could have a historical fact in it, but instead it has the lyrics to a really bad commercial jingle from probably 1972.
That's okay. I've got a few of those lodged in there myself for no no coherent reason, but I can't clean them out no matter how hard I try.
They're good at that. They're so good at that.
Joanne, before we let you go, you got some other things you're working on. Tell us about something special that you'd like folks to know about.
Oh, sure. Well, what I'd like folks to know about is a kind of webinar, although that sounds more formal than it is, that I'm doing every Thursday morning, 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time, called History Matters and So Does Coffee. And it's really an informal conversation in which I talk a little bit about something about the past and how it really sheds light on the present. I use a lot of primary documents and photographs and documents because I love talking about that stuff. And then I open things up for questions. So it's about 45 minutes every Thursday morning, and I really invite people to come along. They can find the link on Thursday mornings at nche.net/conversations.
That's wonderful. By the way, I thought of you a couple of weeks ago. We had actress Elizabeth Davis on, who was on Broadway in the musical Once, and she was telling us that she's going to be appearing in a new version of 1776 at American Repertory Theater at Cambridge with all women in the cast.
I am dying to see that production. I can't even tell you. I'm like, every once in a while I go online and I'm like, can I get tickets? I'm a major 1776 fan.
And I always try
to. I tell people that in its own weird way, to a lesser degree, was the Hamilton of its day. Actually, this is a final Mark story we can conclude with, my brother. So Mark and Richard and I, the three of us, whenever we went anywhere in the car, we made my poor parents play the music to 1776. Of course, they had an 8-track tape because this was the olden days. And I've now been in the car with my brother Mark and my niece Olivia. And when she was a little younger, she insisted that Hamilton be played anytime she was in the car. And I just felt like it was karma.
That's perfect. What goes around comes around, sometimes
Absolutely.
In very good ways. Well, Joanne, thank you as always. Wonderful to catch up with you again. We appreciate you making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.